If you are a regular fan of this show, you know we define story and storyteller very broadly. Educators, artists, scholars, and more all qualify in our eyes, but occasionally we meet a talent that weaves all three skills together with a profound humanity that commends their work to us as they inspire and even heal others. Today's guest is just such a person. She's Patricia Nguyen, this week on Story in the Public Square. And welcome to Story in the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. I'm Jim Lutis from the Pell Center at Salve Regina University. Alongside me is my friend and co-host, G. Wayne Miller of the Providence Journal. Each week, we talk about big issues with great guests, authors, journalists, artists, and more, to make sense of the stories that shape public life in the United States today. To help us this week, we're joined by Patricia Nguyen, an artist, educator, and scholar who uses art to heal wounds and build community. Patricia, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much, Jim and Wayne, for having me.
So you were born in Chicago, but your parents were born in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. What was their life like before they came to the United States?
Well, Vietnam went through a series of wars with Chinese, French, and the U.S., but they weren't around when the Chinese were fighting them until the border wars, but that's separate. But they actually lived during the Vietnam-American War era, and they became refugees after 1975 when the war ended, and so they escaped the country by boat and landed into Malaysia and Indonesia as refugees.
How old were they when they fled Vietnam?
They were in their late 20s and early 30s.
So they had been mature adults through the period of the war.
Right.
Do they talk about it?
They do, in different ways. My mom talks about her life growing up and living in the countryside of Vietnam. My father talks about going into education and becoming a professor in the Mekong Delta region. And that actually led to his incarceration because he was on the opposing side of the communist government that ended up winning the war. And so he was actually incarcerated for about 4 years in re-education camps.
Wow.
And that kind of sparked a lot of my journey into thinking about nation building, state violence, memory, and heritage trauma, and what the role of performance can do to share these stories beyond the boundaries of academia.
So what happened to him during those 4 years of incarceration? That's a very long time, and I'm assuming the conditions were not uplifting, for lack of a better word.
Yeah, they were extremely terrible. So the war ended in April 30th, 1975, and just a few weeks later, they rounded people up into these abandoned schools to say that they would just go into re-education workshop sessions for a few days. And then in the middle of the night, they had AK-47s and they rounded them up, at least for my father who lived in Saigon, or what is known as Ho Chi Minh City now, into the jungle, about a kilometer from the Vietnam-Cambodia border. And that was during the time of the Khmer Rouge as well. Mm-hmm. And so part of his torture was that it was starvation, it was forced labor. And so when the U.S. Fought in Vietnam, they actually buried these mines. And so part of their punishment was to dig up these mines. And they didn't even have proper equipment. What they had was just a stick. And they would squat and bend over on the ground and just tap on the earth and then begin to kind of uncover these landmines that were buried during the war and then build their own shelter for incarceration.
So is that, from the regime's perspective, is that, so if you kill some political prisoners, so what, you're getting rid of mines?
Right, so the way that it was framed, because even Amnesty International had stepped in and talked to the Vietnamese government at the time and said that these are a violation of human rights and that people deserve a proper trial and all of that. And so there was a lot of things that they did to try to get around that, but they said that these were people who opposed the freedom of the country and the independence of the country, so they're actually war criminals that deserve to be punished in this way, and that was actually, they were offering it as re-education. So instead of calling it a prison, they called it re-education.
So your parents were married at that time, is that correct?
They actually met in Chicago.
Really?
They met in Chicago.
Yeah,
okay,
so they didn't even know each other during the war. They didn't know each other during their time in refugee camps. Yeah.
And they got out separately.
They got out separately.
And they met in Chicago.
So yeah. how did they get out? I mean, that's a long journey from 4 years of incarceration. I don't know how long your mother was incarcerated. How did they physically get out? I mean, how did they escape, I guess, is the word, right?
Yeah.
What was that journey like?
So my father actually lives in political exile because he escaped from jail.
Really?
And so he left the country as a boat refugee and landed in Malaysia. After a few nights, 3 to 4 nights over the on the ocean. And my mother escaped from the southern tip of Vietnam from Kamau City, and she actually tried to get to the Malaysian refugee camps, but during that time there were massive boat pushbacks because the refugee camps were overcrowded, so she had to spend a few more days at sea until they landed in Indonesia.
So they came to Chicago, and they met in Chicago.
Yeah.
How did they meet? I mean, I'm just fascinated by the story with all its detail.
So there at Northeastern University, there was a free program for refugees to
Northeastern.
Northeastern. So I teach at Northwestern.
Okay.
At another university.
In Boston, Northeastern.
Chicago.
Okay.
And so there was a free program for refugees to earn their bachelor's degree. And so that's where they met.
So growing up, you heard these stories from your parents. And so that clearly influenced both your life, your childhood and your adulthood, and headed you in a certain direction.
Yeah.
When did you know you wanted to do something close to what you're doing now in terms of healing, in terms of performance art, in terms of helping other people, particularly people who were from or still are in Vietnam?
Thanks for that question. I often think about what led me to where I am now and to do all these different things that seem kind of disparately connected. But actually, there's different points that I can locate, but growing up in Chicago, they had a lot of programs for what they call inner city youth. And so I was one of those youth that participated in poetry classes, creative writing classes. And so that's where I began to learn the power of writing and the pen. And then I joined actually a poetry collective close to my during the tail end of my high school years. And it was called YAP, Young Asians with Power. And so that was, it was cute, you know, and they centered spoken word, but what they really centered was thinking through immigration history and how it impacted our stories and used creative writing as an outlet to process that. And so I took that with me because I had all these stories that I felt the burden of telling in many ways, growing up with just hearing stories of war and state violence and being refugees, and I didn't really quite know where to put it until I joined this collective that offered me a space to talk about it and to express it. And then in college, I did some more of that work with local Southeast Asian communities with young people who had formerly been incarcerated in juvenile detention, just to kind of learn about how the Vietnam War, the Khmer Rouge, how genocide and war impacts our life circumstances into resettlement, into a new country.
So you attended Pomona College.
Yeah.
You got a bachelor's degree in sociology, but then you went, after graduation, you went to Vietnam.
Yes,
And you describe that journey as, and I'm quoting here, a journey of healing and reparation.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, and so my whole life I grew up in Chicago and I wanted to go back to Vietnam, and I say the word back, because for those that live in the diaspora, it's a notion of going back even if you've never visited the mm-hmm. country or never even heard of it or just seen it or experienced it. And so going back to Vietnam for the first time after college was this journey of trying to understand what the other side of the war looked like. And the way that I journeyed doing that was working with survivors of sex trafficking, human trafficking at the border of Vietnam and China and Vietnam and Cambodia. And the women that I worked with were ethnic minorities or indigenous women. And so I was like, how do we traverse across these linguistic and educational barriers? And it was through art. It was through performance, it was through visual art, it was through doing movement work and theater work with them that we were able to connect with each other and heal through the various levels of trauma that they had been through.
So who were some of these women? I mean, not by name, obviously,
oh,
but
yes,
where they lived, what part of Vietnam, and what was their history? Obviously, they'd been sex trafficked.
Yeah.
But what were their personal histories? You were there for a year or two, is that correct?
Yeah, I lived there for 2 years.
So you got to know these people.
Yeah, I worked in their reintegration shelters. And the one that I worked in specifically was at the border of Vietnam and China. And some of these women, young women, were 13 to early 20s when they were trafficked into brothels, into forced marriages. And a lot of the times it was because of the government having kind of opened its borders in some ways and thinking through various economic development policies that actually decrease the life chances of those who live in more rural areas.
We need to take a quick moment for station identification. This is Storying the Public Square, where storytelling meets public affairs. An audio version of this show can be heard 4 times every weekend on Sirius XM Satellite Radio's popular Politics of the United States. That's the POTUS channel, number 124. We produce Story in the Public Square with a great crew at Rhode Island PBS, and we're lucky to work with them. I'm Jim Lutis. On most days, you can find me running the Pell Center at Salve Regina University in beautiful Newport, Rhode Island. If you want to connect with me on Twitter, you can do so at JM Lutis. Joining me, as he does every week in the co-host chair, is my friend G. Wayne Miller, who's the author of 17 books and is also an award-winning journalist with the Providence Journal. You can find Wayne on Twitter, too, at G. Wayne Miller. And our guest this week is Patricia Nguyen, an artist, educator, and scholar who's also assistant professor and director of undergraduate studies at Northwestern University. Her research and performance work examines critical refugee studies, political economy, forced migration, oral histories, inherited trauma, torture, and nation building in both the United States and in Vietnam.
So how did art and dance and what you do help in that work, connecting with these people and moving toward healing?
It was a way of thinking through how art can be another means of storytelling, how art can be a way in which they can make sense of their past and speculate what their futures could be, and also learn about women's empowerment through theater and through drawing. And so I actually was able to create a larger mural project with the young women, and a lot of them, Vietnamese was actually their second language because they were ethnic minorities from other regions. And so we were able to create a mural that marked and traced where they had come from, the economic conditions that they had lived in agriculture, and then where their life chances are.
So your sociology degree from Pomona.
Yeah.
That's not what prepared you to do this.
No, not at all.
It might have helped a little along the way.
Right, but what? So how does one find themselves working with formerly trafficked sex workers in Southeast Asia?
Yeah. Two reasons mainly. The first reason was I wanted to go back to Vietnam and I wanted to understand where my parents came from and who's affected in the aftermath of war. And the second is to understand how neoliberal development policies end up impacting those most vulnerable. And so I wanted to work with a population that was most impacted by the shifting economic policies of the country.
So you came back to the U.S., back to Chicago, and what did you do? You've got 2 years of experience with these people. How did you translate that into your work in Chicago? And we're going to get into what you do now in a moment.
But. Oh, sure, yes. So I kept hitting a wall when I was in Vietnam. I just felt like there were certain things I couldn't say because of issues with censorship and things like that. And so I wanted to go back to school. I wanted an avenue to make sense of and have a larger analysis of transnational trade policies and thinking through how political economy affects the personal lives of people, but through performance. So it seems kind of separated. And then I found this program at Northwestern University in performance studies where people were studying human rights through performance. And I thought that was really powerful.
What does that mean?
Yeah.
I'm a historian. I've been around a lot of international relations theories programs.
Yeah.
How do you study international human rights through performance?
So there's so many different ways in which we can kind of enter that conversation, but thinking through even the way in which we see and understand the court system, or the way in which we understand how reparations movements are pushed forward, and the staging of that, what it looks like in a Congress, what it looks like in the court as a stage itself, how we can use the tool of performance to understand power relations and dynamics, and the ways that like lighting plays into that, how people are positioned, how people are speaking in relation to each other, their tone, their movements in a space, or their ability to move or to not move in specific spaces. I know that's kind of more broad and abstract, but the way that I had originally studied it was thinking through how performance can address certain issues that human rights law and mm-hmm. international language kind of limits in some ways, and how performance can touch on those issues, address those issues, but also push beyond it for us to kind of imagine what else could be possible.
So how do you use performance? Are you on a stage? Are you in a museum and with an audience? And who might that audience be?
Yeah, I perform in a lot of different spaces, from museums to gallery spaces to the street, and thinking about the site specificity of the street. For example, I did a performance commemorating the 40th anniversary of the Vietnam-American War at the lake where John McCain was shot down at in Vietnam, in wow. Hanoi, thinking about the site specificity of that. I've performed at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Chicago on issues of Southeast Asian deportation, and thinking through the materiality of confinement in some ways, and working with just like metals, and working with wood, and working with also those space fabrics that are used in a lot of detention centers, and so really thinking about that in relationship to the body.
Does the healing through performance happen for the artist or for the audience or both? Is it a dialogue? I guess I'm trying to understand the pathway to healing.
Yeah, it's both and so I've performed a piece called Salt Water that reflects on the journey of boat refugees, Vietnamese boat refugees, and connected it to the boat exodus of folks from Northern Africa across the Mediterranean. Mm. And so for people who have experienced that journey, it allows them a sense of catharsis in some ways. Those are some things that people have shared with me. And for those who've never experienced it, it incites a sense of urgency and wanting to address these issues and learn more about these issues. But I also use performance in workshops and more educational settings with people who are survivors of torture or of war, and that's where I find it most healing, because a lot of these traumas are stuck in the muscle memories of our body, and so I work through performance and movement to release those kind of stuck memories that inhibit and limit movement to breathe air into it a little bit more and to strengthen it so people can feel more empowered in their own body when they've experienced circumstances where they've had limited life choices.
So what do they tell you, the people who participate in this and are doing something that they've probably never done before, use the term cathartic?
Yeah.
What kind of feedback do you get from them? Is it like, thank you for doing this, I found something within myself I hadn't thought of? Tell me, what does it do?
So I've led this one workshop that I'm exploring a little bit more that I'll go into also that actually inspired a memorial project. It's called Breath, Form, and Freedom. And so I was exploring the idea of breath and breath in the body. Because a lot of the times, even something as simple and basic as when we experience anxiety or have panic attacks, we can't breathe. It's difficult to breathe. And so I actually connect that to Franz Fanon, who is a anti-colonial theorist who's written about combat breathing. And he's talked about combat breathing in the sense of how to colonize subjects or those who've been under conditions of duress and oppression breathe and fight back through their breath. And so I've led breathing workshops and movement workshops that kind of exacerbate the way in which people can and cannot breathe to play with that range. And people have talked about how they've been able to realize their own awareness of breath and how it came into close proximity with their relationship with death and their relationship with police violence, their relationship with environmental racism and asthma that they've experienced in the communities that they've grown up in. And so it becomes both a, wow, I feel stronger in my body, I feel my own breath again, but I'm connecting it to these larger issues that are impacting me.
So there's clearly a mental health impact. Mm. In doing this. I mean, I'm reminded of mindfulness. I mean, it seems to have a relationship to that. You are clearly an expert in trauma. Your family has experienced trauma. You have dealt with a lot of people who have experienced trauma, and you know the effects of trauma can be lifelong. They can show up in terms of depression, PTSD, and other clinical diagnoses.
Right.
There's also some emerging scientific evidence that trauma can be inherited, that even if you do not yourself personally experience trauma, mm-hmm. or you have actually experienced trauma, that children as yet unborn or grandchildren as yet unborn mm-hmm. can have some biological effect. Talk about inherited trauma. It's a relatively new field. Yeah. I think it's still controversial to an extent, but there is scientific evidence. Science Magazine recently did an article on this very issue. Talk about that.
Yeah, absolutely.
After my long-winded
introduction. Oh, no, that was wonderful. No, that was great. I think about inherited trauma through multiple ways. And, of course, through the scientific lens and thinking about how it impacts epigenetics and the ways in which, like, genes are actually, there's actual shifts that happen that increase the rates of anxiety and also carried on PTSD and depression in children of refugees or children who have experienced or their parents who have experienced genocide and war.
And these are children who themselves have not experienced
who
it because of that genetic link through their parents. There's an effect.
Absolutely. And they carry over what their parents have gone through in many ways, because a lot of the times in a lot of refugee communities, people don't really share about their experiences. They don't really talk about what they've gone through from the war and the aftermath of it. And so how do we make sense of inherited trauma if it's not somebody shouting, this is what happened, this is what I went through? How do we understand how it lives in the body, how it lives in our genes, how it lives in the way that we understand how to breathe or how to move, how to deal with conflict, how anger arises and how we negotiate that? And so I also think about it in a different way as well, in terms of how inherited trauma is also linked to the way that we even understand our own bodies and how, like, there's water carries memory, and I'm connecting this to a lot of Black scholars that have studied the transatlantic slave trade, and thinking through the body of water as carrying a lot of memory, and how that gets, and how the majority of our own bodies are made up of water as well. And so how do we make sense of that in the way that we conjure or pull up memory in our own bodies that connect to these histories?
You just completed another work with another artist called Breath, Form, and Freedom, which is a public memorial to the victims of torture, alleged torture, by former Chicago police commander John Burge. Tell us about that piece.
Yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
And him first, because it was relatively new to me when we talked before we went on air.
Oh, yes, yeah. So so John Burge was actually trained by the CIA for assassination missions and also to torture people during the Vietnam-American War. And then he learned those torture techniques and brought them back to Chicago as a Chicago police officer and then a commander that led a midnight crew that would torture predominantly Black men and some women for over two decades. And over 100 people have come out to share their stories, and some of which are still incarcerated and some of which have been incarcerated for over 30 to 40 years. A few have been on death row, and all of under false accusations, and a lot of them were tortured through suffocation, through electrocution, into forced confessions of crimes they've never committed. And so this memorial honors their life. And it was spearheaded by the Chicago Torture Justice Memorial Project, which is actually part of this larger reparations ordinance that was passed in Chicago. So Chicago is the first municipality in the country that has passed a reparations ordinance that addresses police violence. And so part of that ordinance includes things such as public school curriculum on this issue, public education, college education for survivors and their family members, and also this memorial. And so right now we're actually hopefully going to get funded by the city of Chicago, but we're still under, we're still in conversation with the newly elected mayor. And so we're hopeful that this memorial will be funded. But part of the process was having survivors talk about what they wanted the memorial to look like. And so 100% of the survivors wanted their names to appear on the memorial.
Wow.
So we wanted, that was a non-negotiable. So we wanted to make sure that that was there. And the memorial is also an educational tool in many ways. And so, yes, hopefully folks can read more about it. It's on the Chicago Tribune and WTTW.
It's fascinating work. Patricia Nguyen, thank you so much for being with us. That's all the time we have this week, but if you want to know more about Story in the Public Square, you can find us on Facebook and Twitter or visit pellcenter.org. He's Wayne, I'm Jim, asking you to join us again next time for more Story in the Public Square.